It has been more than a year since the Taliban banned teenage girls in Afghanistan from school. And women there can't attend college, aren't allowed to work with aid groups, or even go to amusement parks. In essence, they cannot lead normal lives. We've been speaking to young girls whose dreams have been stifled and women protesters who have been standing up against this crackdown in the face of serious threats. Nick Schifrin has their stories.
Afghan women are undaunted, but they're hunted. The woman in the red scarf we'll call Roya. She and her friends are at war. The Taliban target her and other female activists who dare to protest, including last August on what they call the dark day, 1 year of Taliban rule. We spoke to her by phone and are protecting her identity.
They beat me and my friends up. Most of us were held hostage. They were shooting guns right in front of us, and they were threatening us.
Before the Taliban takeover, she worked in the government. Her daughters attended school. They and she lost everything. She's fighting for the life she once had, and for that, she's punished.
They hit my back with the butt of a rifle. They hit my hands with a whip. They kicked me, too. Just like me, most of my friends have been beaten up and arrested. Some of my friends were Taliban hostages for almost a month.
Nevertheless, she persists, demanding change, but suffering immediate blowback.
After every protest, I couldn't go home for almost a month because there was the possibility of my location being discovered and my getting arrested. Each time after I protest, I receive calls from anonymous numbers. They warn me that if I protest again or come out onto the street, I will be killed or vanished in a way that nobody will be able to understand what happened to me.
And yet her acts of courage create confidence in a younger generation, including this 20-year-old college student we'll call Farah.
I'm watching women who are protesting in the streets. It's a big hope for us. And if there would be a revolution, absolutely it will be done by women.
She was studying to become a dentist, but now she's banned from college. So the student has become the professor. She's teaching English at a secret school online.
I still have hope. I am teaching girls who are banned to get an education through online platforms. I record my voice, I record presentations. Our activities are somehow under radar.
And that's what saves her, because the Taliban track secret schools. She understands the risk.
They can kill me or they can put me in jail. They will torture me. I'm resolved to do it because I believe that these opportunities that I'm providing for girls really deserve it. They have gotten depression. They're crying all the time.
Depression is a harsh reality for most young Afghan women. One, we'll call Fauzia, used to be the happiest girl in school. Now her hopes have been crushed.
This is really, really dark, and I think that my all wishes and my all dreams are die, and I can't achieve them. I don't know what to do, and that's really broke my heart, and it's really bad. I was a girl with big dreams. I really don't know what will happen, and I don't see any brightness. I don't see any light thing in my future.
That darkness is literal for a woman we'll call Bibi.
Right now I'm in a very dark and small room where I'm scared that a Talib could just come any time.
She, too, used to be a government employee. Last year she protested multiple times. She says she's willing to sacrifice her blood for freedom.
My family is really scared for my life. They tell me that one day you will get killed, your life is in danger, and we won't even be able to find your body. But when I think about it, everything I do is worth it. If my blood brings education or human rights to the next generation of Afghan women, I'm ready to do it.
Now it's not just a fight for human rights, it's a fight for survival. This hospital is full of children suffering from pneumonia. And these parents pray over their own child's grave. He died last week of hypothermia. This has been the worst winter in a decade, and two-thirds of the country needs humanitarian assistance.
The situation here is way worse than it is reported in the media. People are facing extreme poverty and hunger here. When I go to the bakery to buy bread, people are just like ships lined up outside. Men and women waiting for someone to give them bread.
We spoke to the UN's top humanitarian official, Martin Griffiths, before the earthquake in Turkey.
What conditions did you see there? What conditions do Afghans currently face?
It's dire. And there's a reason why Afghanistan is the largest humanitarian aid program in the world in this year, because they've suffered terrible droughts. They are experiencing an extraordinarily brutal winter. 6 million people in Afghanistan are close to famine-like conditions, and 28 million need humanitarian assistance. It's grim.
I don't mean to date you, but you have been working in Afghanistan for 4 decades. Have you ever seen conditions like the conditions that Afghanistan faces today?
This is about as bad as it gets, because it's the combination of the effect of climate change, the effect of decades of conflict, and the isolation of Afghanistan, which came along with the Taliban taking over the country a year and a half ago. So the banking system doesn't work. You can't make transactions. People can't access their bank accounts. They desperately need and depend on humanitarian aid.
The Taliban have banned women from working with domestic and international non-governmental organizations. You've called that a potential death blow for your humanitarian efforts in Afghanistan. Why?
Without women working in the delivery of humanitarian assistance, we can't access women and girls. And women and girls are always our primary target beneficiary for humanitarian assistance and protection. And in Afghanistan, that means you must have women working in the front lines of humanitarian organizations. Otherwise, we won't know if we've reached the right people, understood the assessment of the need, on top of the rights of women, which have been impeded by these edicts.
And so what was your message to the Taliban?
The message was, first of all, very clear. This edict from the 24th of December, stopping women work, does you no favors. It needs to be rescinded. Two sectors at least, health and education, have already since that edict of last month been exempted from it. The second message to all those Taliban leaders that I met with my colleagues is expand those exemptions to all the sectors that require assistance, whether it's refugees, whether it's basic services, whether it's protection against gender-based violence. And the reaction from the Taliban was, we understand your concern, this is a universal response, and we are in fact in the process of preparing guidelines. And they said, I think you will be positively surprised by those guidelines. Well, we'll have to see.
You said that the Taliban have asked you to be patient while waiting for those guidelines. You've dealt with the Taliban for decades. Are they just stalling?
No, I don't think they're stalling. But patience is not unlimited. They hope to have these guidelines done and out by March. I hope so too. But there's one more thing which needs to happen. And this is, I think, almost as important. And that is that the international community needs to engage with the Taliban, across the board, engagement with the Taliban on all issues like counterterrorism, like counter-narcotics, about the economy, because there are many things that we could do for the people of Afghanistan, which has been held back because of the lack of a relationship and engagement with the Taliban.
Washington says that it is not impeding any kind of humanitarian access, but of course, the U.S. maintains Afghanistan's foreign reserves frozen in international institutions. Do you believe the U.S. needs to change its policy and have more engagement with the Taliban and less punishment of the Taliban?
My message to the U.S. government is exercise your leadership to ensure that Afghanistan is not an isolated, insulated, obscure place, but a place that we understand the positions of its leaders, and that we approve eventually of the ways in which they allow us to help their people.
At the same time, I've talked to other humanitarian officials who believe that you and the UN are a little too deferential to host countries, and that they would want you to criticize host countries publicly rather than keep any criticism private in the hope that you will maintain your access to the country. What's your response to some of that criticism?
I think the record is pretty clear that punitive rhetoric or punishment, they have a pretty poor record of achieving the results that we need to see. So I am a believer in encouragement and clarity and accountability as a means of engaging.
And regardless of the policy, the people of Afghanistan desperately need help quickly, right?
They desperately need help quickly. Isolation means people die when they need food.
Martin Griffiths, the UN's top humanitarian official, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nick.